This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, it's a great pleasure to have in the studio with me two friends of mine from Madison, who also just happen to be the two leading media reformers in the country. Their names, of course, are Robert W. McChesney, that's Bob to me and you, and John Nichols. Bob teaches in the Department of Communications at the University of Illinois, and John's the Washington correspondent for The Nation and associate editor of the Capital Times in Madison. They're the co-founders with Josh Silver of Free Press, and they've written several books together, none better nor more urgent than their latest one entitled The Death and Life of American Journalism. Bob and John, welcome back to Progressive Radio.
Great to be here.
Thanks, Matt.
Let's get to the heart of the current crisis, which is newspapers, at least print newspapers, seem to be dying. Why is that?
Well, I can say, as somebody who's been a print journalist since I was 11 years old, that I don't think they're dying because people don't want news anymore. I think they're dying because of a number of factors, which we talk about a lot in the book, that are not discussed much in the media itself. The primary one is that the people who own most of our big newspapers today are not interested in civic or democratic values. They're there for commercial and entertainment values, and primarily to make a lot of money. And many of them acquired big newspapers at huge costs. They paid more than they should have for them. And while they're still making money, there's still money coming in, it's not enough for them to post the 30-40% profits that they want. So rather than, you know, accepting that reality and readjusting, some of them are actually closing newspapers. We've seen the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, the Rocky Mountain News close down as well. It's about 140 smaller papers last year. We have threats to big dailies in San Francisco, Detroit, Boston, and other places. But the more serious problem is the papers that are actually staying open. But the way that these very large corporations keep them functioning, if you will, is by laying off journalists. And last year, in fact, over the last 2 years, we've seen a pattern that newspapers have been laying off, firing, more than 1,000 employees a month. And those numbers are just devastating. Those employees are the people who staff Washington bureaus, city hall bureaus, who cover our government, who really keep the lights on of our civic life. And what's happening with the death of newspapers, and really the death of radio journalism and a lot of TV journalism, is a shuttering of our democratic discourse. It's very unhealthy.
If I can add to that, Matt, I think that we emphasize newspapers in the book, and we talk about newspapers a lot because radio and television journalism is basically dead. That was slaughtered off by corporate conglomerate owners over the past two decades. You know, it wasn't too long ago. We can all remember in the 70s when everyone thought TV journalism would someday usurp the role of newspapers. Well, no one talks in those terms anymore. And I think the point John's making is crucial, is that a lot of the conventional wisdom thinks that the cause of the decline of journalism today is that the internet killed it and it destroyed the business model, or that the Great Recession took away advertising, and that had the internet not come along and had the Great Recession not taken place, everything would be just fine. Our journalism would be going strong. And I think what we demonstrate in the book, and I think that the evidence is fairly overwhelming, is the crisis in journalism began long ago, began decades ago. Young people stopped reading newspapers in the 70s. They used to read it at the same level as older people, and they pretty much stopped reading it altogether by the 90s. That was before the World Wide Web. And I think it goes to the issue that John was talking about. The profit motive ultimately is not compatible with the public service of journalism, particularly when it's sheathed in a conglomerate that makes its money by stripping newsrooms for parts in monopolistic environments.
But it's so convenient then, Bob McChesney and John Nichols, to blame the internet, to have the owners of the newspapers say, well, this new thing came around and we didn't respond well. In fact, in a lot of the journalism self-criticism forums are all saying, well, we should have responded better, and if we'd only done this, that, or the other thing, we'd still be alive. That isn't your analysis, though.
Not at all. I think the evidence is overwhelming that this crisis was in full throttle before the internet affected it. And the internet has basically made permanent the problem, the crisis. It made it faster. It accelerated the process, and it makes it irreversible, but it didn't create it. This crisis, you know, we had this discussions 10 years ago. The internet didn't come up, but we were talking about the decline of journalism.
And if I can just add there, too, one of the other things on the flip side of blaming the internet for the decline in newspaper is the fantasy that the internet is somehow replacing the newspaper. And there's a great new Pew study, and they did it exactly right. They didn't try to do some big national study. They focused in on one city, Baltimore, Maryland, and they looked at all the news coverage from every outlet, online, broadcast, print, everything they could. They really analyzed for a very lengthy period of time. And what they came up with was this: 4% of news stories were being broken and followed in any kind of serious way by internet news operations. The overwhelming majority was still coming from the print press, from the Baltimore Sun. But here's the problem. In this study, they showed that the Baltimore Sun had dramatically fewer employees and was breaking, you know, roughly half as many stories as they were 20 years ago. So here's what we have. The shutting down of newspapers, the decline of newspapers, less and less coverage, while at the same time no real replacement by the web. All the web is doing is aggregating what little coverage is still done by the newspaper. It's a disastrous circumstance. And you know, if the web was replacing the newspapers, great, wonderful. But that's not happening. What we're doing is creating a void. And the news we need as citizens, is falling into that void.
Well, that's the point you make, that the decline, the death of print newspapers is terrible for our democracy. Why is it? How is it?
Well, this is a fundamental democratic theory, that you have to have an informed citizenry if you're going to have not even self-government, but any semblance of the rule of law and constitutional republic, because people in power will almost always gravitate to doing things to benefit themselves that will be to the harm of the republic unless they're held accountable, even if they're democratically elected. I mean, that's built into our constitutional system. And that's why the framers of the Constitution were obsessed with a free press. They were obsessed with understanding that if you don't have a credible press system, the Constitution can't work. And that's why the framers, at the first several generations of the republic, the members of Congress and the president, put into place extraordinary press subsidies to create a press system that never would have existed had it been left to the market. And in the book, we chronicle these subsidies, and we do some original research on it and compile the great historical work that's been done over the past few decades. And I think anyone who reads the book is absolutely astounded at the extent to which we had a heavily subsidized press system for the first 75 years of the nation's history, to the extent that if you took the postal subsidies and the printing subsidies just out of Washington alone and calculated what their value would be today as a percentage of GDP, if the federal government today spent the same amount subsidizing journalism, it would be $30 billion.
And this is a crucial antecedent to your argument toward the end of the book, Bob McChesney and John Nichols, that we need government subsidies today. And I want to get to those in a little bit. But I do want to talk about the problem a little bit more of no news, of mm-hmm. dying newspapers. There'll still be a newspaper or two around, mm-hmm. Maybe even in print for a while. I mean, I think the New York Times will be printed for mm-hmm. a while. The Wall Street Journal will be printed for a while, maybe. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, as I think, John, you were talking about, you know, who's going to be covering the stories? Who's going to be breaking the stories? And what kind of institutional support do you need to break a story? Who's going to be covering City Hall, the Washington bureaus, as you guys outline in this great new book, The Death and Life of American Journalism, are closing all over the place. The science desk, the science mm-hmm. beat reporter is no longer.
The investigative reporting.
Investigative reporting. The
works.
Labor reporting died decades ago.
No, the works. And this to add to your point you're making, Matt, is that this process didn't begin in 2006. This process began in 1980. And it's picked up steam in the last mm-hmm. couple of years. The closing of bureaus was taking place in the 90s.
Well, and let me offer, too, take it to the next step, because I think we're all agreed that things are closing down. It's getting smaller. It's cutting back. So, well, what happens when we decrease the number of reporters, the number of paid journalists, frankly, who are going out and digging on stories? Where does our quote-unquote news come from then? Again, I turn to this Pew study that just came out. What they found is that in Baltimore, using, again, one city, as you dramatically decrease the number of reporters covering local, state, even federal government at that level, more and more stories, in fact, disproportionately more stories, are generated by government, right? The mayor says something, the governor says something, and that's the story. What you lose is the reporter who goes out, does an investigative story, or just digs on a daily basis, finds a story, breaks it, and then government has to respond. So what we're really seeing is a situation where we're reversing the order. Instead of journalists going out, speaking truth to power, challenging power, hopefully pushing it to pay attention to important issues, important matters, we see government making statements, taking actions, and then journalists responding to it. This is a very, very unhealthy pattern in a democratic society.
In fact, John, if I can interject, that's even an optimistic look at what's happening because it's not just government. One of the things we did in the research for the book that was most striking to us that we'd never seen before was we calculated the number of PR officials and the number of journalists per 100,000 people. And in the early 1960s, there were more journalists than PR people.
This is an incredible chart.
It's an incredible chart. Mm-hmm. And we went through, you know, hard data. We had cracked with the crack statisticians going over to make sure it was ironclad. And the gap – now there are more PR people than journalists by the early 1980s, and the gap has increasingly grown as the number of journalists per 100,000 people has shrunk in the last 25 years considerably, and the number of PR agents has almost doubled, even tripled, and the gap continues to grow. And these PR agents include government people, but they also include the corporate community.
And so journalists with journalism jobs closing down are going straight to PR land.
And so the news on public affairs issues increasingly that affect corporate interests, like health care, like the environment, a lot of it's going to be coming increasingly from self-interested corporate PR people who are very good at making you think it's real news.
And if you just do the popcorn a little bit more here, Bob and I going back and forth, and we'll even let you in at some point. But no, if I can just offer one final note on that that's important is that where it really starts to fall apart is in our coverage of politics. And again, this is not a new problem. This is a problem that we've seen developing. But I give you a very good example. You know, if you want to define the last decade and say what was the definitional event of the last decade, I would argue it is the theft of the presidency, that George Bush became president of the United States when he wasn't elected. And you say, well, you know, well, how did the press cover it? Well, the way the press covered it was to put up a Democrat and a Republican arguing about how to count votes instead of stepping back and saying, hold it. Who cares what the Democrats and Republicans say? There are ways to count votes. There are experts. There are people we can do. Same thing happened with the Iraq War, right? You have one general saying, let's attack from the north, another general saying, let's attack from the west. We move to this talking heads pattern, sometimes PR agents, often PR agents, but also, you know, even engaged elected officials, whatever. But with so few journalists working, we end up with a situation where nobody's reporting anymore. And we talk in the book about this incredible pattern with cable talk shows where none of these shows have reporters. And hour after hour of cable television, which is treated – you know, talked about as the news, is actually just talking heads arguing back and forth, basically trying to score points rhetorically – rather than making any effort to inform folks.
Yeah, there's a crisis of reporting. There's no doubt about it. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine, and I'm privileged to have in the studio with me Robert McChesney, Bob McChesney, and John Nichols. They're the authors of this incredibly important new book called The Death and Life of American Journalism. I want to talk – we've talked about the problems. I want to talk about proposed solutions that are out there and why you don't think those are going to work, and then get to the actual solutions that you yourselves propose. The first is that what you call in the book the Internet fabulists, the people who think the Internet is going to solve everything. And you do talk favorably about a couple organizations, Huffington Post, Talking Points Memo, most obviously, as doing really good kind of pioneering work, doing some reporting on the Internet. But why is the Internet – why aren't those models replicable? Why is the Internet not going to solve the problem of this crisis of reporting?
Well, the problem with the Internet is that there's no evidence yet that there's going to be, through the marketplace, anywhere near the resources to generate the number of paid journalists that comes remotely close to what we've expected in this country in the past and what we need to make self-government journalism work. I mean, the number of paid journalists who make their income today through internet journalism probably could fit into a small room. It's simply an almost non-existent number that earn it through marketplace. They aren't bankrolled by some foundation. If you add in the
or independently wealthy,
or independently wealthy,
right?
Or if you add in the ones who are bankrolled by foundations, then the room goes up to maybe 50 people. And the idea that this is going to expand to 100,000 people in our lifetimes is preposterous. All these organizations are scrambling for money. The truth of the matter is that we conclude our critique, and we have a long critique of this, is that journalism's a public good. It's one of those things that the market cannot satisfy. And the fact that advertising came along and supported it for 100 years and provided all its resources gave us the illusion that it was a market-driven phenomenon. But now the evidence is clear, it's not a market-driven phenomenon. Advertisers don't need journalism. They've jumped ship. They're not coming back.
It was a historical accident.
It was a historical accident.
That's a really nice point.
And so, you know, if it's a public good, we can't count on the market. Any more than the market will give us national parks or will give us national defense or public education.
But so some in the foundation world understand that. And they say, well, and they probably agree with you on the point about the internet in the market's not going to do it. So they think, you know, maybe we should pour our money in here. They recognize that it's a public good that's failing us. Why won't foundations themselves be able to take up the slack?
Well, let me offer you a notion here. They don't have enough money. I mean, foundations just took it on the chin pretty hard when, you know, we crashed the global economy a year or so ago. In fact, so hard that many of our civic organizations that have big names, Common Cause, ACLU, have really been scrambling economically. And so at the end of the day, the notion that foundations are going to come in, or even that wealthy people are going to come in and somehow subsidize journalism at the level we need it is absurd. And where in the book we talk about a sort of a real disconnect here is that we talk about these issues so much as regards covering the big national story, covering what the president is doing or covering what Congress is doing. And it is true that HuffPost, who we do speak positively of, has put some reporters in Washington. We think that's fabulous. The president called on a Huffington Post reporter. That's great. That's wonderful. But at the end of the day, The death of journalism is not occurring in Washington per se. We worry about the closing of Washington bureaus. It's occurring in every town across this country, small towns, tough cities that aren't easy places to cover anyway. And you just can't get the foundation to come into every Denver and Chicago and Detroit and you know, these rural communities in the Rocky Mountains. That's just not going to work. And it will be so uneven and so focused toward the big sexy story that at the end of the day, the notion that foundations are somehow A, economically capable of filling the void, or B, really inclined to do all that needs to be done, it's just not realistic. And it I think is dangerous because it slows us down. It causes us to keep waiting for this fantastical result. It's almost as bad as waiting for the market to fix it, right? We'll say, oh, well, you know,
let's
sit back and the money will come back, the advertiser will come back, right? But it's almost as bad to say, well, let's wait for some, you know, noble individual or noble group of individuals to come and solve our problems. That is not a citizen-based response. A citizen-based response says, no, we control our government. The government has immense resources. It just bailed out Wall Street. It just bailed out the auto industry in numbers far higher than anything we're talking about for saving journalism.
But you don't want them to bail out.
No, they don't want to bail out
the New York Times or the Boston
Globe. No, not at all. No.
And you know, just to put an exclamation point on John's issue, we would never say, hey, let's hope that Warren Buffett will bankroll our national defense, our police departments. We understand that's something you have to have done regardless of the cost. You do it first, then you take care of the cost later. That's how journalism is. It's not something you try to get on the cheap. If you do, you don't have a free society.
And this idea that newspapers should just go nonprofit, the New York Times should go nonprofit and beg people for money, like I do at the Progressive,
or like National Public Radio,
or like NPR does.
Well, you know, I think again it gets to the public good nature. That's a fine source of revenues, but it's not going to cover the job. For all the evidence we see, is that it's going to require a public subsidy to have journalism. There's simply the marketplace will not generate it, and there's not enough money in the sort of donor camp to do so.
So let's talk about this public subsidy idea before we get into the specifics. Let's try to clear the threshold criticism, which is, you know, this, you're getting the government involved in the media, and that's breaching either the literal or the you know, metaphorical reason behind the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me offer you, as a First Amendment absolutist, somebody who's really passionate about it, let me take it from a couple of places. First off, we have heavily subsidized media in much of the world and in many, many other countries. And most studies will tell you that those countries are the countries with the most heavily subsidized journalism, the most government engagement in places like Scandinavia or even Britain with the BBC, are very free societies. Scandinavian societies especially rate as freer than the United States, a broader, better public discourse than the United States. So that's your first model. But also the second thing is, you say, well, if the government gets involved, somehow it's going to taint it. Somehow it's going to destroy it. Well, look, the government is, whether we want to acknowledge it or not, very involved in making religion function in the United States, right? You can deduct your contributions to churches. There's all sorts of other structural supports for churches. They don't pay taxes, all sorts of things like that. And somehow in this country, we have an incredibly diverse religious community, including folks who are very, very critical of the government. And so it just this notion that the government is somehow the government getting engaged in setting up a landscape in which people really can practice journalism from a lot of different perspectives in a lot of different ways will somehow taint it or undermine it is disproven both in clear press models internationally, but also domestically. It and on realities historically and in the current day.
Well, that's where I was driving, John Nichols, there, because I was going to go bounce this over to Bob McChesney, who all your scholarship has been based on the assumption that you've proven over and over again that the government's always been involved in the media to one extent or another.
Well, you look at our news media the last 30 years. I mean, our television broadcasters exist and our cable broadcasters exist because of government monopoly licenses they received, usually behind closed doors for free, that are worth enormous amounts of money. So they're really not independent media. And, you know, it's ironic because John and I share the concern of government censorship as much as anyone. We'd probably be the first ones to be censored if we had it. It's ironic that people who are so concerned about this issue, which is a very legitimate issue, saw nothing wrong with the fact that our television broadcasters, who depend on government for all sorts of benefits, were basically printing government positions on the Gulf War and the Iraq War, and that there was no concern there. But suddenly it's a concern when we might do it out in the open and set up independent news media that would be clear, visible, transparent, that their operations would be independent of any government control, which is what they do in Scandinavia. And the point to touch on what John said on that, too, is that commercial media and private media prosper in Europe as a result of these subsidies. They're not threatened. In fact, Freedom House, this very pro-commercial, pro-private media organization that rates press freedom every year around the world, puts the most heavily subsidized democracies in the world in the top six positions of free private press in the world. The United States ranks tied for 21st. So the evidence shows, in fact, that the increase in public subsidies in Europe led to a feistier press, a more robust press, a stronger press, not a weaker, complacent press. That's what we get without press subsidies. We have journalists who are dependent upon government for handouts.
Let me give you a practical example, too. In the book, we talked to one of the editors of the Guardian newspaper in London, and the Guardian is such a good website, such good web presence, and also good newspaper in general, that its circulation in the United States is huge. There are a number of Americans who go there to get their news about the world, especially during the Iraq War as it was ramping up. So Guardian, really good quality, overall recognized around the world as fantastic. It is a it happens to be run by a trust, but it's in the private sector. I said to him, you know, why is the Guardian so good? Why is it so remarkable? And why do you do all this for free? Why is your website free and everything? And he said, well, you know, our competition is the BBC. And so here you have this government-structured media outlet there, and it makes all of the private sector media in England better because they've got to compete with something that's very, very good.
I'm speaking with John Nichols, who's just been talking, and Robert McChesney. They're the author of this great book, The Death and Life of American Journalism, subtitled The Media Revolution That Will Begin the World Again. Let's get specific on the kind of subsidies you're talking about. Some are in the initial stage to stop the bleeding, as you call it, and what would those be?
Well, I think the point we want to make is we threw some ideas out in Chapter 4 we'd thought about. we have no doubt that these can be improved upon. We just want to give something tangible for people to sink their teeth into, and I think listeners would like to hear what that means. But we just want to open the debate, not close it. Immediately, I think what we have to do is put a lot more money into public and community radio and television, and specifically with the mandate to increase journalism, particularly at the local level, where we have town after town with virtually no journalists anymore, and we have out-of-work journalists, and we have institutions in place ready to go. Secondly, I think we're losing a generation of young people who not only consume journalism but produce it. We've got to use the AmeriCorps program to bankroll hundreds of thousands of young kids who want to become journalists to go out and work for media, get experience, sort of like the WPA in the 30s.
I like that idea when I came across
on
it.
On websites, too.
AmeriCorps for journalists.
Yeah, and we're losing a generation. I teach journalism. We've lost a generation of kids, and they aren't necessarily coming back. This is a crisis. We can't afford to lose young people. I don't want to dwell on this way, but I've got young people now who don't know anything about the world because they have not exposed to journalism.
Mm-hmm. And let me offer just one quick, easy one that goes back to the founding of the Republic. The postal structure in this country makes it very, very hard for smaller journals of opinion to circulate.
Tell me about it.
You know it. At The Nation, we know it. And so we'd like to intervene there. Let's make it cheap to and easy for people to circulate a journal of opinion. But let's also do something else. And let's borrow an idea from Scandinavia and say that, you know, we want to give citizens some power in deciding what media should exist out there. So why shouldn't you be able to subscribe to two or three newspapers, four or five magazines, and take that off your taxes? Now, that's going to take some money out of the government's treasury that it would have gotten, but that's where we fill in that gap. And there you have citizens picking the media they want to support, donating money to it, maybe donating to the Progressive, donating to a radio station, donating to a website, and at a very low cost, actually sustaining a lot of media with the government just in there basically to do the tax structure.
This is your $200 voucher idea.
Well, right? John's actually adding this one. This wasn't even in the book. John's already updating our book.
Oh, sorry.
We're in the second edition here. This leads, though, to our other idea. Subsidies we've just talked about, the condition would be that everything's produced goes online for free,
right,
is in the public domain. So we're boosting up the quality of journalism in the public domain. But the most important thing is thinking visionary. We're going to be in a entirely digital world at some point. We're heading there rapidly. But we have to just come up with a way to subsidize independent journalism that's going to be largely online. And our vision of a $200 citizenship news voucher is that every citizen should have the right to dedicate $200 to any nonprofit, non-commercial news medium of their choice, as long as it meets certain criteria.
Now, a lot of these ideas are great, but almost all of them collide with the power structure in this country.
Yeah.
We've got about a minute left to deal with that. That is these huge corporations and all their lobbyists. You know, we've seen what they've done to healthcare reform. We've seen what they've done across the board. How do you expect to make these changes when you have these behemoths out there?
Well, not to rely on Noam Chomsky too much here, but Chomsky always says that you know, you advance good public policy often when the elites divide. And one of the interesting realities is that today we do have divided elites on some of these issues. And you know that some of the biggest internet players are really concerned about the loss of content. They're not getting enough content anymore. And so there are openings here to fight.
That's
but the
right.
real bottom line, the real so that's a practical reality. The real bottom line is, as Bob and I've said for years, we've got to counter organized money with organized people.
Also,
this is an issue.
We're in a deep crisis. This is not normal times. We're in a period where journalism is disintegrating. It's a moment which people are looking for real solutions. And I think the reason why our book will be successful is that all the other stuff that's bandied about is on the surface preposterous. Mm-hmm. This is a difficult road to go down, but it's the only road that's going to pay off. Mm-hmm.
I highly recommend that everyone who's listening here should go buy this book, The Death and Life of American Journalism, The Media Revolution That Will Begin the World Again. My guests have been the authors of the book, Robert McChesney and John Nichols. Bob and John, thanks so much.
Thank you, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.